Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Andrea Lorien, one of the producers on the show, and what you're about to listen to has been edited for clarity and brevity.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Michaela Lafrac. Vermont is calling on the federal government to assess storm damage from last week's flooding. The state filed its request with FEMA on Saturday. If it's accepted, Vermont will again be eligible for a major disaster declaration and federal funds. Assessments will be done in Addison, Orleans, Washington, Caledonia, Chittenden, Lamoille, Orange, and Essex counties. For many communities, this is deja vu from last July. But that doesn't mean that some things haven't changed. Later in the show, we're going to learn about efforts to restore Vermont's watersheds, a key way to keep floodwaters out of homes and downtowns. We'll also hear a personal story from a woman in Plainfield whose home and possessions were destroyed last week. To recover from that type of devastation, many Vermonters rely on the help of volunteers, friends, community members, sometimes people they've never met before who live nearby. We're going to kick off today's show with a look at the grassroots recovery efforts going on right now in the Northeast Kingdom and in Barrie City. We're joined first by Prim Linsky. He's the construction project manager with Barrie Up. It's a long-term recovery organization for Barrie City. Prim, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Oh, tell us what your weekend was like.
16-hour days in the mud, the sewerage, just helping coordinate efforts in the city of Barrie, moving volunteers around from house to house, sending people out to do assessments on houses around the city, just making sure everybody was fed, making sure the volunteers that were coming out had the tools that they needed, and making sure that the homeowners felt listened to, cared for, and we're given the time of day that they deserved.
Hmm. What were some of the things that you were hearing from homeowners whose homes were affected last week?
Yeah, so people are angry in the city. People definitely feel like there are things that have been talked about and promised over the past year that haven't happened yet. People are feeling pretty hopeless. Their homes keep flooding and it's getting worse. Yeah, it's really heartbreaking to hear these same houses keep flooding time after time. They were put in floodplains, and as somebody just said a minute ago on the TV from Cambridge, that there's no affordable housing that's not in the floodplain, and that's really the biggest thing. Is a lot of these folks that are living in the floodplain would love to move. They would love to get a buyout from the city, but the buyouts aren't coming. They're not enough. And after they pay their mortgage off and pay the debts that they've taken out to fix their house from the last year's flood, there's no place to go. And I'd really like to see us call on the state to do something about it, do something for affordable housing. It would be great if we could put an end to all these short-term rentals across the state and all these second homes and really, start to take care of people that have, are working in the state, are living in floodplains and getting flooded out. It would really help open up things for a lot of folks.
And Prem, you mentioned the buyout program. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to speak with a state hazard mitigation officer who is helping to organize the buyout program, which is managed by FEMA and the federal government, and also there's a state role there as well. So if you're interested in learning more about that, be sure to join us tomorrow at noon on Vermont Edition. Prem, you mentioned that you've heard a lot of anger in the last couple of days. Where is that anger directed?
I primarily work in Barrie City. That's what Barrie Up is focusing on. And a lot of people are angry with FEMA, which is obvious. I've been doing disaster recovery work for about 8 years now. And that's I try to always mitigate people's expectations of FEMA. People are angry with the city. The storm drains are full of mud. They didn't really do much this last time. The river's constantly overflowing. People have been talked to about buyouts and elevations for a year now. It feels like it's happening slow. And you know, I understand, like, the city has to work within their confines and with what they've got, you know, but I think residents just want things to happen soon, which makes sense. You know, the chances of another flood this summer are pretty high. At this point, the groundwater is saturated. You know, it's going to be like last year where it was like every time it rained after our big flood, everything flooded again. People are scared to live in their homes and they're angry that there's no place to go. They're angry that you know, people are getting angry with investors coming to their state and taking all the affordable housing. People are just angry that there's no dumpsters out, like all the dumpsters are full here. You know, they feel like nobody's coming to help. You know, people are grateful that Barry Up is showing up and we're resident focused, but we're here and that's really it. You know, they just want more and they deserve more, you know.
Tell us more about Barry Up. Who runs the organization? Who funds it?
Yeah, so Barry Up is volunteer run. I am the only paid employee here, and I'm a LLC. So I was contracted out to do rebuild construction work that we got through a grant from Vermont Community Foundation, who is also doing a lot of our funding. We have our executive director, Shauna Trader. Pam Wilson is one of our case managers and also a volunteer, but gives lots and lots of hours to it. But we just have a wonderful board. We have a wonderful group of core volunteers that are here. And we just rely on grants from other organizations. And again, Vermont Community Foundation was a really big one for that. And, we're just doing what we can to help our local community here.
Now, Prem, your efforts in Barry City are being mirrored in other parts of the state, including the Northeast Kingdom. Earlier this morning, I spoke with the co-chairs of the organization CURVE, that's Kingdom United Resilience and Recovery Effort. Here's co-chair Kari White explaining what her past weekend has been like.
So this past weekend, I think has in equal parts been inspiring and overwhelming. Inspiring in the fact that as we see time and time again, neighbors step up to help neighbors, and new folks emerge from the woodwork to assist in any way they possibly can, and just jump into it. To take quick action to help the people that they love, people that they don't even know. The sort of overwhelming part is, I guess, the intense coordination that needs to go on to really meet all of the needs in a kind of efficient and good enough way. I'll say that, you know, the Northeast Kingdom, which we attempt to kind of unify and coordinate and cover, is 2,000 square miles, right? It's 55 towns and municipalities. So you're not just dealing with one town or one city. You're dealing with 55, right? That's 55 different emergency contexts. That's 55 different community leaders or entities that are really helping out their friends and neighbors. So trying to be supportive of that is what we're trying to do to build capacity in communities, because that's where recovery happens.
Now, Kari there is working in a much more rural, spread out area in the Northeast Kingdom. It's a very different scene in many ways from Barry City. But Prem, is it also hard to coordinate relief efforts in some ways for you all?
The struggles that they're having up in the Northeast Kingdom, I have so much sympathy for. I ran a program up through like Lamoille County last year from the flood, and it is just so spread out. It's so difficult to get to everything. We have a pretty good idea of who was flooded and where down in Barry City. It's easy for me. Like if I forget a wheelbarrow, it takes me 5 minutes to get a wheelbarrow to a site. When lunches show up, it's 5 minutes and I can have all my teams fed. It's so different here in that regard. And I just want to make sure it's known that they are doing some amazing work up there. And the roads, there's road blockages everywhere. Yeah, so we've got our own things to deal with here. They're definitely different. They're definitely big challenges, but I know how difficult it is when you're spread out over 55 towns and municipalities. Like it's a huge area that they need to get around to. And that's not one of the challenges we see here. We see plenty, but that's just not one of them.
Yeah. Megan Whelan, another one of the co-chairs of CURVE, told me that one of the main things that she learned in the wake of the 2023 flooding was that certain neighborhoods and towns are going to get a lot more attention and support than others. That could be because of existing neighbor-to-neighbor networks, could be because of wealth, could be because of other things. Does that feel the same in Barrie, maybe in comparison to other parts of the state?
Yeah, I think that Barrie being Barrie, it definitely gets more attention. I think we get an entire neighborhood here will flood and be devastated. And I hate to say it, but that's it's easy for a camera crew to come out and show the devastation scale when they're pointing a camera down one road and houses full of mud and devastated. And I do think that we see the poorest parts of Barrie being flooded. That's definitely true. In Johnson, the trailer park got wiped out, you know. It's we tend to put these homes that are cheaper in these floodplains. And that's what we're seeing here, is just a high density of those homes in one area. But we definitely get more attention here in Barrie. I think Montpelier gets a lot as well, Waterbury, but it's so hard when you're talking about something like the Northeast Kingdom where it is Meg. When I worked with Megan last summer, she's like, it's a scattershot up here. You know, it's hard to find the people. You really have to put the effort in, and Barrie definitely gets more attention.
Well, I also asked Megan during our conversation this morning if the folks at Kingdom United Resilience and Recovery Effort, CURVE, if they learned a lot from their experiences last year after the flooding that has helped them this year. And Megan and her co-chair, Kari, said yes and no, but it's just really not that simple. So let's take a listen to their response here. Here's Megan, and then you'll hear Kari, and then Megan once more.
We've learned a lot, and yet this still feels crazy. And I think part of that is the extent of the geographical area and the need that we're seeing.
And I would say you said this, Megan, too, the pre-existing issues that are already there, right? You have so many socioeconomic barriers to living a thriving, healthy life here in many parts of the kingdom. And then you had COVID, and then you had the July 2023 flooding, and now you have the July 2024 flooding. I mean, the folks impacted by the 2023 flooding are nowhere near recovered. We're still trying to hold that recovery and rebuilding work down and build a whole new arm that can help support relief efforts in neighborhoods for a whole huge new swath of people in the kingdom. So we have learned a lot. I think we're much better coordinated than we were last year, and it's still so capacity it demands so much capacity of people. It's hard.
So one of the biggest things that I'm feeling is this level of dread. And I know that there's people far and wide who want to contribute. And I think volunteering and donating are good things for them to be plugged into. But on my mind is of people to support are the people who have dove headfirst into this recovery and now have the weight of seeing all the devastation on their shoulders and then having to coordinate dehumidifiers and volunteers and are getting a million emails and phone calls and text messages and are trying to figure out how to watch their kids and eat dinner and take a nap. And it's almost an impossible burden. And there are, I'm worried about the people out there shouldering it and how we can reach them and say, you're not alone too. Like you, we want to help connect and resource those folks because we've been you and we are you again.
An impossible burden, Megan called it. Prem, I wonder what you think of that wording.
Yeah, I mean, I say often it's like the picture is far too big to look at. So like, you just need to take it piece by piece. We were working on three homes doing rebuild work that all reflooded. It feels like it's just never ending. You know, the only upside to it was we had tools on the site that we needed the morning after the flood. I can see how difficult it is. I feel bad for the homeowners, the volunteers that keep coming out, the people in all these long-term recovery groups across the state that are volunteering and stepping up in their spare time to put massive effort in here. Like, I'm grateful for my experience. Like, I've been doing this for a long time around the country and the world, and I have some wonderful friends that I could call to come lead teams with me who have years of disaster recovery experience. I've built connections with, like, Resource is the one doing all my rebuild work. Huge shout out to them. And Youth Build, like the Youth Build programs have been very important to our rebuild and recovery efforts now. And I got to use that this time around on this flood. You know, it's kind of second nature to me to, like, show up after a disaster and do coordination and make it happen. But it's so difficult, you know, and it's a burnout job. You know, most disaster recovery case managers last 7 months, you know, most disaster recovery workers last like 6-7 months. It's a burnout job. And a lot of people were already pretty burnt out before this happened. And that doesn't even begin to explain like the difficulties that a homeowner who is already, I have people who are $100,000 in debt and just had their house completely ruined again, and have no place to go. And again, are like, even if I wanted to, even if I had a down payment for a house, I cannot compete in the market right now. And nobody's talking about it. Nobody's doing anything about it. So yeah, people, it's just, it feels far too much. But right now we're just trying to muck out the houses in front of us. We're trying to find the next house to go to, and we're trying to keep our volunteers and our helpers, you know, hopeful, and our homeowners feeling listened to and heard. But the long-term recovery groups in the state have been at it for a year, and they're doing amazing work. And we just need more people to come help out, like long-term volunteers in these long-term recovery groups would be great. We need help rebuilding still from last year and this year, and there'll be another flood, you know, it will happen again. And I'm hoping for some great stuff to come out of the person who's speaking next. You know, I think a lot of people in Barrie City see that, like, the more we build up this state, you know, there's no groundwater saturation on pavement. It all rushes down the hill. These new developments, all the water rushes down the hill into their house every time there's a lot of rain. So, like, we got to figure something out here so that this doesn't keep happening to people. And we got to figure out what to do about these short-term rentals and these second homes. Even if they were taxed higher to help pay these flood victims to go put a down payment on a house someplace else. It's time for us to, like, as a community, come together and put up the effort to help each other, help our neighbors, and help people stay local.
Prem Linsky is the construction project manager with Barrie Up. They're a long-term recovery organization for Barrie City, working very hard right now to help folks in Barrie City clean up and move forward following last week's flooding. Prem, thank you so much for speaking with us today amid what I am sure is such a busy time for you and your colleagues. Thank you.
Thank you so much. And I just want to thank all the people that are coming out and volunteering and helping out in this and just letting the homeowners know that they're not alone. There are people out there here to help.
Thank you, Prem.
Thank you.
Many of Vermont's towns sit in valleys with rivers rutted right by. Take Plainfield in Washington County. Last week, the community was devastated by flooding. Vermont Public reporter Erica Heilman spoke with Plainfield resident Allison Doe over the weekend. She lost her house, her cat, and all her belongings in the flood.
It started kind of early, like I was told, watch out, we got a flash flood warning or whatever. And I didn't really understand what a flash flood was, you know. The home I was in was there for 74 years without being hurt. So I never expected the whole house to be taken away into the river and destroyed. Everything. Everything that I own for my whole life and worked for, my animal, my cat, is the most important thing. Captain, he's my buddy, you know, my best friend. And not just my things, important things, but things from my mom, my dad, or my brother that have all passed away. And being in a house where you see the dirt, the dark water just bursting through the door. In fact, it busted the door open. So it was pouring in like spurts, huge spurts, 5-foot spurts, so fast it was destroying everything. In fact, it tore the whole kitchen down. And I was in the bedroom, in the back bedroom with the cat, trying to keep him safe. It's my fault, really, because I should have left a lot sooner. I didn't know where to go, but because I can't walk either. My leg, there's something very wrong with my leg. We don't know what it is yet, but I can't walk. I could feel the house getting hit every few seconds by trees and rocks, and it was terrifying. But I was calling for help for like 2 hours because I didn't hear from the fire department, and I lost my phone somehow. So I couldn't call again. And all of a sudden I could hear it ring. I put my cat up I had a ladder in the house about 6 feet maybe, and I put my cat on the upper floor to keep him safe from water coming in case the door bursted open again. And I found the phone and I could hear it ringing. It was this lady here, my neighbor, calling to see if I was okay. And I said, no, I'm trapped. I said, I called the fire department over an hour ago. And I said, can your sons maybe try to help me or something to get out of here? And she said, yeah, we'll be right over. And this is 11 o'clock at night. I'd been calling for help for 2 hours. And it was so loud, like rocks hitting rocks constantly in the water. It was so loud, I kept getting hit in the building, like I said, it was kept shaking. And I finally said the Lord's Prayer because I knew I didn't have much time at all, maybe 5 minutes. And I was ready, and I said, Lord, I'm ready. And that's when the fire department showed up. And banged on the window, and they finally had to break the window in as fast as possible. I didn't want to put them in danger. They were waiting for me. And then I said, I have to get my cat. And they said, it's now or never. You have to leave now or not at all. And I looked back and forth several times. I called to them. And I had to dive out the window. I didn't want to risk their safety. It's a horrible choice. And then as we were leaving, crossing the road, walking across trees and stuff, you know, the house has given way completely. I was calling to him, hoping he'd be right behind me. And I don't know where he is, 2 days later, almost.
That was Allison Doe of Plainfield speaking to Vermont Public's Erica Heilman. And listening to Allison's voice there, many of you, like me, might be thinking, isn't there any way that we can prevent these storms from being so destructive? Our next guest is focused on just that. Shane Jaquith is a watershed restoration program manager at the Nature Conservancy. He worked with the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation's Rivers Program for 16 years before that. Shane joined us last year, right after the historic flooding in July 2023, to talk about their work. He joins us again today. Shane, welcome.
Thank you, Michaela.
Shane, first, you were listening to Allison's story along with us. What did that bring up for you?
Yeah, thank you. I did intend to start by acknowledging and expressing sympathy, certainly for everybody impacted. And that story, boy, that just really hits hard, and it just brings out a lot of emotion for those people who really have suffered from these events. And I've been working in this field for approximately 20 years, sometimes in a situation where I was working directly with flood victims, and it never gets easier to hear those stories. And it feels so tragic that we have to continue to create these stories, and people have to go through these experiences, as we've seen recently, sometimes the same people over and over again. So it just makes me feel really sad, and for everybody who has to go through these events.
Yeah. Well, Shane, you and your colleagues are working to make sure that this happens, hopefully less often or in a less severe way when those extreme rains hit Vermont. As you just mentioned, there are certain communities that get inundated particularly hard during major flood events, including in Vermont's deep mountain valleys. Why is that?
Well, there's different scenarios. We see Barrie and Barrie City get hit over and over again. And there we have a combination of development patterns, really dense development patterns in these low-lying floodplain areas. And we have streams like, the Gunners Brook that comes into Barrie City. And the stream, in many cases, the development, in these floodplain areas, those are the areas that the rivers naturally overtop and spill their water onto during these high flow events. And so, the land use and the development in those areas just sets us up for disasters during these high flow events. Other locations, and this is also a factor, in places like Barrie and Barrie City, is that, upstream of these areas, where we also have floodplains, that under natural conditions, the rivers would spill high flows onto, where those flows would slow down, energies would be dissipated, preventing erosion and damage to downstream villages. But our historic approach to river management to accommodate surrounding land uses, and this goes back to European settlement, and it is something that has happened around the world. It's not just Vermont, it's just not the US. This is a global management, common management strategy, where we dredge and straighten and armor our river channels to accommodate surrounding land uses. And it's not surprising we do this. These are very well-suited sites for development and agriculture. But over the longer term, these areas, as we are experiencing, prove to be very hazardous. And so when these streams are dredged again, and they are disconnected from their floodplains, so when you get these high flow events, instead of that floodwater spilling out onto these floodplains under natural conditions, which would be forested and slowing and trapping water and dissipating all of that erosive energy, these waters are transported downstream, and inevitably they pass through a section of channel that has a lot of dense development right around it. And that's the recipe for disaster that we have set up.
Mm. We're discussing watershed management and restoration right now with Shane Jaquith of the Nature Conservancy. If you have questions about watershed restoration, or if it's an area you work in and have something to add, give us a call at 800-639-2211 or email vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Let's hone in here a little bit more on dredging, Shane, because as I understand it, it's also a way to prevent rivers and streams from overflowing, to make them deeper. But there's a limit to how much you can do that, right?
Yeah, and this is a great question because intuitively it makes all the sense in the world, right? As you just said, if our buildings are getting wet, then let's make the channels deeper. Let's make the pipe bigger, and transport that water downstream. And it makes a lot of sense. So that's what the early European settlers started doing, and that's what we kept doing to the modern day. But what happens when you do that is that you really trade that erosion. I'm sorry, you trade that flooding, that inundation damage. And inundation is when the floodwaters come up, they saturate buildings, they deposit sediment, and it leaves a huge mess, right? That's an inundation damage. But there's also erosion damage that occurs during flooding. And erosion damage is by far the more expensive damage across Vermont from flooding. And erosion damage, what I mean is houses getting undermined, roadways getting undermined by the river channel as it moves side to side because the energy in the channel is so great. So when you dredge rivers, you ultimately trade out an inundation problem for an erosion problem. And the reason that is, again, is because when you, under natural conditions, river channels have banks that are pretty low. So imagine yourself standing in the river and maybe the bank, the height of the bank is up to your waist. And that represents a natural condition. And when a large flow comes through that channel, that flow can easily spread out. It can overtop those banks and spread out onto that floodplain. And that floodplain is the energy dissipation device. It's the pressure relief valve for the river system. And river channels, of course, are not copper. They're not steel. They're just, gravel and sand. So when the pressure in that channel gets too high, they start to crumble and they enlarge, they move, they send sediment downstream in large volumes. So when we dredge the channel, we take away that pressure relief valve, and that leads to a lot of river instability. And again, that leads to that erosion damage that we experience in Vermont so much.
Shane, is there a lot of active dredging going on in the state right now, or is the challenge trying to rehabilitate rivers and streams that were previously dredged too deep?
Yeah, the amount of dredging has really been curtailed quite a bit. It still happens. There are still places where we need to dredge. We need to protect existing developments. But the dredging today, I'd say, differs from that of the past, that it's more sophisticated. There's a design process. We look at we do topographic survey. We use hydrologic and hydraulic models to design a dredging job or practice that is really going to be effective and going to be less impactful. And where we have to dredge, that's the way we go about it. And we accept that that's going to inevitably bring about some issues, but we have to protect those areas that are already developed. So we are still dredging a little bit, but it's largely been curtailed. It's more sophisticated, and it's really designed through a scientific process. But the challenge really is to let then help those rivers that have been dredged. And once rivers are dredged and straightened, and you increase the energy in those channels, they start to go through this natural channel evolution process in which they really downcut or gully. They erode the bed of the channel, and those channels just get deeper and deeper on their own. And eventually they start to really widen out. So these channels really, they just blow up. They get really large. And the Vermont Department of Environmental Conservation has done assessments of river channels on the ground. They've assessed 5,000 miles of river. And for reference, there's about 23,000 miles of river mapped in the state. They've assessed about 5,000 miles and found that 75% of those assessed rivers are in this state of being incised and enlarged and disconnected from their floodplain, so they don't have that pressure relief valve available to them. So yeah, the work really is to help rehabilitate those river channels and reconnect them to their floodplains.
Shane, let's take some questions from callers now. We have Rainbow in Burlington on the line. Rainbow, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I have been saying this before. I'm Dutch. Why don't we build dikes? I mean, obviously the dredging hasn't stopped the flooding. Let's build some dikes, okay? Instead of having to rebuild houses that flow down the river. Thank you.
Thanks, Rainbow.
And I would like to know why we don't.
Thanks, Rainbow. Shane?
Yeah, so dikes or levees or berms, you know, all similar names for essentially the same structure. These are structures that prevent the water from spilling out onto the floodplain and impacting surrounding developments. And building berms was an early strategy along with dredging. But once again, when you build a berm and you trap those higher flows in the channel just starts to erode because the amount of stream power in that channel is just increased beyond a point that the gravels and the cobbles and the sands that make up the bed and banks of that channel can withstand. So we actually, after Tropical Storm Irene, there was a prohibition on berming. Because berms, again, they separate the river from the floodplain, and the river needs that energy dissipation valve to again dissipate energies, so and take pressure off of the channel. And again, channel erosion instability is by far our most expensive flood-related damage in Vermont.
Thank you for the question, Rainbow. Let's go next to Amanda in Montpelier. Amanda, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Well, I have several questions, but we live just like 5 feet from the North Branch River, and our flood wall, like the wall that they had made like 50 years ago, had fallen in. And I'm just wondering, like, what I can plant or like help my riverbank. And also I have one other question is,
sure,
like as far as how much light pollution is on the river and how much like we need to like love the river. Does that sound cheesy?
Sorry, can you repeat your second question there about pollution?
Well,
I couldn't quite hear you.
More about like how much light pollution is on the, like, we don't like really take care of our river at all in Vermont. Like we have so much salt. I mean, just we don't take care of our rivers.
Mm. Thank you, Amanda. Well, let's start with the first part of Amanda's comment. What to plant along a riverbank to help deter erosion, Shane?
Yeah, that's a great question. And certainly vegetated riverbanks are very important to the health of rivers. So, you know, what we should plant are those species that we see naturally occurring along riverbanks. So in the shrub category, there's red oak or dogwood. There's all the different kinds of native willows that we see. There's speckled alder getting into larger trees. You know, they're, depending on where you are, it might be green ash, you know, red maple, ash, really all, most all of the native tree species. You know, you see hemlock and white pine. So it really is a, you know, a strategy of returning these systems back to the condition they were in, the natural condition that they were in. So it's just a matter of planting the native species that exist here and that you see along riverbanks.
Hmm. And Amanda also had a bit more broad question about her concern for rivers themselves and the pollution that she's noticed. And I want to kind of tie that into my next question for you, Shane, which is about the Flood Safety Act, which was passed this legislative session. And it has all these different components to it to protect wetlands, to regulate development in river corridors. And it's something that the Nature Conservancy, your employer, lobbied really hard for. Let's start first with these regulations on new development in river corridors that the state is now being mandated to create. What's the timeline for that? And what exactly is that going to change?
Yeah, sure. So the Flood Safety Act is a culmination of a decade at least of work and consensus building around the scientific understanding that again, our rivers need floodplains. They need to spill into the floodplains to dissipate erosive energy. So the act, it really represents a very significant advancement in flood resilience policy in Vermont. And as you said, there are three components. There is the river corridor piece that I was describing. There's also a dam safety component, and then there's a wetlands protection component. And the Nature Conservancy did put resources into advocating for the passage of the River Corridors or Flood Safety Act, because we really see it as a large-scale, long-term, durable solution that is going to end these repeated stories of devastation. So we did advocate for the act, and what it's going to do is it is going to put place authority within the Agency of Natural Resources, particularly the Department of Environmental Conservation, to regulate development within river corridors. And river corridors are essentially floodplains. We can think of them as floodplains, although they are mapped by the state and not mapped by FEMA, which is who maps the river corridors. And river corridors are mapped according, they're really identifying those areas, not just that get wet, but more importantly, again, those areas that are susceptible to devastating erosion, because the National Flood Insurance Program does not consider erosion hazard areas and does not help recover from erosion hazard in many cases. So the state really started advancing this idea that it needed to come up with a way to protect against erosion hazards, and mapping river corridors and regulating development within river corridors is that answer. So the timeline, there's education and outreach period and consulting with stakeholders on setting up that permitting program. And I think that runs between, it starts pretty much immediately, or, January 2025 and runs through 2027. And ultimately, the rule is completed in 2027. The permitting rule that ANR has to come up with is completed in 2027. And the rule becomes effective on January 1, 2028.
Well, I saw that Governor Phil Scott has raised concerns about the timeline for building out all these new regulations being unreasonable. Do you think that it's possible to do all of this in that amount of time?
Michaela, I don't engage with the administrative branch and the policy folks as much as I do focus on the science. So I really can't speak to how feasible that is. I guess I should leave it at that. I really can't speak to that.
Sure. Well, we just got an email from a listener named Michelle with the Friends for the Winooski River organization. Michelle urges listeners to landowners specifically to contact Friends of the Winooski River for resources to help regarding the river. Shane, in the minute or two that we have left here, do you have suggestions, resources for people who, maybe specifically landowners who want to try to do their best to keep their land healthy and to help prevent flooding all down the river?
Yeah, I think starting with, you know, we have a great network of nonprofit organizations, TNC, of course, Vermont River Conservancy. Michelle is the director of one of our wonderful local watershed organizations. They are a fantastic resource. Our natural resource conservation districts are very helpful. Lake Champlain Basin Program, and of course the Department of Environmental Conservation, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. There are multitudes of resources and programs to reach out to that can help with these issues.
And Shane, lastly, what's short term the project, the work that you are focusing on right now? What comes next for you and your work?
Yeah, so the passage of the Flood Safety Act was really important, but now we move on to implementation. And there are some things that need to be done under that the act, such as figuring out how we identify those areas, those downtown and village center areas that we know we need to respect, where we know we need to respect development and continue to develop, but do so in such a way that doesn't increase erosion hazards. That's something that needs to be done by the agency, and TNC has jumped into that, and we're facilitating a collaborative stakeholder process to help try to come up with a way to do that. So that's a big piece of work for us going forward. I mentioned the education and outreach component. We'd like to be involved in that. And then we have on the ground restoration projects in which we're trying to restore river floodplain connectivity. We're working on increasing culverts, which we didn't talk about, but are a big part of the problem, undersized culverts, and then removing old and dilapidated dams that pose potential flood hazard risks during these flow events.
Shane Jaquith is the Watershed Restoration Manager with the Nature Conservancy. Shane, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much, Michaela.
Shane was last on Vermont Edition last July following the historic flooding then. Well, that is it for today's show. This is a conversation we would very much like to return to soon, though. So if you have questions about watershed management, perhaps you're a landowner wondering how best to care for that portion of the river that flows close to your home or land, you can email us anytime at vermontedition@vermontpublic.org. Today's show was directed by Liz Fullerton and produced by Andrea Lorien and Daniela Fierro. Our call screener today was Kelly Delorier, and our theme music is by Myra Flynn. I'm Michaela LaFrac. Thank you so much for listening, and we'll catch up again soon.